this. Peter Kettle, the Let Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Is it working, Ben Stone?
I can feel it. Hey, MK, how you doing?
All right. Oh, I'm doing stellar. What about you?
I'm doing pretty well. Pretty well. We should also mention that the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no-gov license that allows reuse by anyone except government, and learn more at BIPCOT.org, BIPCOT.org. So what's happening, MK?
That's right. Well, Florida's pretty great. We were talking earlier. I want to bring this up at the beginning. The graffiti wall, the picture that you sent me from Gainesville.
Oh, yeah.
It says worms.
Isn't that cool?
A Fiends fan is in Gainesville. This is so cool.
Yeah, the Gainesville graffiti wall is a wall that was... Let me scroll to my notes.
I love this thing.
Say that again.
I'm sorry, what?
What did you just say?
Kind of cut out there. Oh, I was saying, so this is in Gainesville. This is about 6 hours from where I'm at in Florida. And I guess we were thinking it was by maybe a student who went to University of Florida. Or this is near University of Florida. So it says worms over a really cool looking anarchy sign.
Yeah, the Gainesville graffiti wall is a retaining wall that's really close to the campus. So it's kind of like the students use it almost like a bulletin board. It's actually the 34th Street wall. It's 1,100 feet long. And
wow, I wish I was better at graffiti.
Yeah. And we were talking about that before we started, too, that, you know, at least my opinion is I think graffiti's pretty cool. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of graffiti. Now, there's a property rights argument. You say, well, you know, if you're running a business and somebody comes up and puts graffiti all over your walls, that can be disruptive or it can be a blight on the community and all these different things like this. But I make I see a difference.
You differentiate.
Yes, there you go. Between defacing someone's private property and putting graffiti in public. So like on the side of a subway train, I don't accept the common beliefs about public property. So because of that, and that we could do like a whole radio show on just on the concepts of public property. But since I am an anarchist, I do not believe that there's such a thing as public property. I think all property is either owned or unowned. And I think non-existing entities can't own property. So society is not an entity. It's kind of like the difference between the trees and a forest. You can walk out and touch a tree. You can cut a tree down. You can, you know, climb the tree. You can pick fruit from the tree, but you can't touch a forest because the forest only exists in the human mind, in our perception. And I see public property as being, if you want to make the argument that public property is owned by all of society, well, society is not a real thing. It only exists in the minds of humans that perceive it. So it's exactly like a forest. You can't go touch society. You can't talk to society. You can't interact with society because society is not a person. And since it's not a person, it has no property rights. Anyway, that's a long rant over over graffiti. So get out there, kids, and tag that stuff.
Yeah, there's like I said, I wish I was better at graffiti because there's a graffiti bridge in Pensacola right before you get out to the beach, and everyone puts, you know, all kinds of cool graffiti. Like if someone's promoting an event, for example, they'll paint the whole bridge, you know, one color and be like, look this up, you know, promote my event. And then it always gets painted over. It's just so cool to see all the different artwork that comes out. Anyone's allowed to paint on it. It's like this piece of so-called public property. I would say it's unowned. It's really cool. It's always really colorful, and it's very much a staple of Pensacola. So I love stuff like that. I love seeing spontaneous art, you know, kind of floating up in the public. So more art. More art's always good.
Before my wife and I leave the area, we're in southern Alabama. I want to drive down there and take a look at that. We haven't really got to look around Pensacola very much anyway. We've kind of stayed on the Alabama side and over towards Mobile and then on over towards Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But I'd really like to get over towards Pensacola and at least look around a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Come on by. I'll show you around. It's a cool little place. And, yeah, you can even go to the beach if you guys are into that. Or there's some cool places downtown, too, that you guys would probably like.
And for anybody listening that doesn't know what we're talking about, the Freedom Fiends radio show that you're listening to, we're also on the internet as freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com. But we're on the radio. So if you're hearing this on the radio and you're like, who are these people? What are they talking about? Well, we've got, I don't know, probably 12 or 15 different co-hosts. Do you know the exact number, Megan?
I've lost count now. I remember it was like 13 for a while. I think it may be up to 15 now. I know Jim Babb has joined and Jim Jesus and,
I was really excited.
It's a lot of hosts. It keeps things interesting.
Yeah, it does. And that's part of the flavor of the Freedom Fiends is that we have so many different people. That means we have that many different opinions. We have that many different, you know, experiences in life, different ages. I think Randy England is probably lower to mid-60s. I'm mid-50s. You know, Michael is about 50. And, you know, then we go all the way down the spectrum. Nick is 16, I believe, or maybe he might be 17 by now, but I think he's around 16 or 17. And so the co-hosts are a real wide variety of people with a wide variety of opinions and experiences, but we have certain things we have in common, like we're fanaticals for freedom. We really want humans to be free, and that's our great desire, and that's the thing that we share, and that's the thing that we talk about. So
that's right.
Oh, and the other direction I was going to take that. So me, Ben Stone, is one of those co-hosts. Sort of my thing is my wife and I are full-time RVers. We live in a nice motor coach. We travel around the country. We go from campground to campground, and we never really stay in one place more than 2 or 3 weeks, and we move to another place. And it's a lot of fun. We really like the RV lifestyle. We're retired. And so, you know, it's just a really fun way of living life. And then other people are different ways. You know, MK lives there in Pensacola and has like a regular job where she has to go to work every day. But she does have the advantage of having a really cool boss. I really like Tim. He's a good guy.
Yeah. I have the coolest boss. I know anarchists give some people who, you know, work kind of crap for this, like, oh, you have a wage slave job or whatever. It's like, I don't even think of it that way. I have the best job ever, and it allows me a lot of freedom to do what I like to do and what I'm really passionate about, too. So I really hit the jackpot with that. But yeah, I used to want to travel around. I was very close a few years ago to buying a camper van and just like selling all of my stuff and just like winging it and just like following bands around for a while. Like I was really close to doing that because I love traveling a lot. I love, you know, getting out of my hometown and checking out other places. So that's something I hope to one day have the opportunity to do is, you know, hit the road and really get to travel around a lot and see a lot of different places and meet a lot of different people. So sounds awesome.
My daughter that used to co-host with me on occasion over at the Bad Quaker podcast, she is hiking the Appalachian Trail right now. She's, I think, somewhere wow. about the Tennessee, North Carolina, Kentucky area, that triangle right in there. And she
oh, cool.
She broke off. She's going to go do some Ren Fair, some Renaissance Festival circuits to build up a little bit more money to, you know, pay her way the rest of the way. But she has hiked that far so far this year, and now she's breaking off. She's going to some, I'm not even sure. Oh, I think she's going to Colorado. She got out of there.
Cool.
She had enough, you know, money stashed away so that when she got to that point, she could break out, hit the airport, fly to Colorado, do the Renaissance Festival, and then fly back to North Carolina and jump back into the Appalachian Trail again. And she's got a pretty good shot of completing it. This is her second try on the trail.
Wow.
So that would be great. I don't have the health for something like that, but that would be fun.
Wow, that's so cool. That's so adventurous. And I love camping and being out in nature, too. And I do want to get a chance to travel back to Colorado at some point to do some hiking and just really see some more scenery and terrain, really, because it's so flat where I'm at. There's not a whole... There's trails you can kind of go through, but it's all like kind of wooded area. There's not really, it's not like hiking in the mountains or something. So so I like seeing a little more terrain and camping out. And yeah, that sounds like such an adventure. I hope she completes it too. That's awesome.
I hope so. She had kind of had an idea of trying to finish it by around the time Porkfest is in New Hampshire, and that would put her like 30 miles from Porkfest or something like that. But the time frames just didn't work out, so she wasn't able to do it. But Porkfest gets a free shout out on the show just for good measure.
There you go. Has she been to Porkfest before? Is that something?
Yeah, she was there. Or? I think 2012. I don't think 2013. I think she's been there twice, if I recall. I can't remember for sure. Yeah, she was there twice. She was there 2012 and 2013, and then missed it last year. Yeah, Porkfest is a lot of fun.
It is, yeah.
So we're starting to head towards our commercial break, so I wanted to tease a little bit. Today we've got a couple topics we wanted to talk about, Bitcoin being one of them, and some other interesting stuff like the Silk Road and all the controversy with that that's surrounded that. What did you say, Megan? I think I talked over you.
I'm hearing a lot of cutouts right now. I'm trying to keep up. It'll be silent for a while, and then it'll jumble your side up. So I'm not quite sure. I wasn't saying anything though.
Is the buff dump on your Fiend phone? Is it building up pretty bad? Is that maybe causing it?
I'm thinking that's what it is. Yeah.
You can just hit that buff dump. That might.
I hit it earlier. Right. Yeah. I just hit it, and it's. We'll see. We'll get through these technological differences.
Yeah. I should mention, too, that we are using Fiend Phone. Fiend Phone is software that's developed just for this show, but it's also available for everybody else for free. You can find it at fiendphone.com. And one of our faithful listeners, Derek Slopey, has developed it just for us because he's a great guy, and he's really brilliant, and he's a genius, and I really like Derek. He's really cool. And when we get back from this...
Derek's the best.
He is. When we get back from this trip to the market, we'll have some better stuff to talk about instead of just rambling on like this.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
The central scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN or virtual private network from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Freedom Fiends on the radio. So, Megan, when we were off air there, we were talking about Bitcoin. So let's tell the folks what we were talking about with Bitcoin. I have here, I guess it was a week or two ago, Jeffrey Tucker was on Fox Business News, and he did a really good explanation of Bitcoin. I was really impressed because, first off, they treated him with respect. They gave him the proper time to explain himself. They didn't interrupt him. They didn't try to make a fool out of him. They really let him say his thing and describe what Bitcoin was. And then the lady that did the interview on him, she had a couple of basic questions, which were the standard typical stuff that where people misunderstand, like, isn't Bitcoin anonymous, and how do you know there's no record of transactions, and who isn't it all based on trust? And of course it's not anonymous, it's not all based on trust, it's not, you know, it's all verifiable. That's what the blockchain does. The blockchain is the aspect of Bitcoin that makes it verifiable and makes it viable. And Jeffrey did a really good job of explaining that. And during the break, MK also did a really good job of explaining that, but of course that didn't go out. So Megan, explain for the folks what the basic objections or misunderstandings are those things that, oh, well, it's just drug money, or it's all anonymous, or there's no way to verify it, or what is the truth about all these things?
So Bitcoin kind of has this bad reputation for being this currency that drug dealers and maladjusted freaks kind of use. But it's actually just an alternative currency that anyone can use, and people from all aspects of life do use, just for buying anything from coffee to pizzas to, yeah, maybe hard drugs sometimes. Currency is something that is neutral. People use cash for the same reasons. You know, we're not all up in arms about how evil cash is, you know, unless you're, I don't know, unless you're a little bit crazy. You know, people use cash for these kinds of, you know, bad or immoral kinds of things, but the currency itself is neutral. So Bitcoin is another type of currency that is basically atop a payment system that allows you to send value to anywhere else. Think of it as kind of like PayPal with its own tokens that allows you to send those tokens to anywhere in the world with about half a percentage in transaction fees. So this is really a breakthrough in currency because it's a worldwide phenomenon and allows you to send money from here to someone in China for the same amount as you would send it from, you know, here to someone sitting right next to you. And Jeffrey is a great communicator about this because he really breaks it down simply. Like you said in the interview, there are a lot of misconceptions, for example, about anonymity. It's not a completely anonymous currency. In fact, it's kind of the opposite in a lot of ways. You can basically look up any transaction in Bitcoin on the blockchain, which is a public ledger. It shows all of the transactions that have ever taken place from the very first transaction. And if you can match up an address, which is a line of letters and numbers that a person holds that basically contains their Bitcoin, if you can match it up to that individual, you can look that address up on this record and see where they have sent and received Bitcoin. Now, people think it's anonymous because these addresses are very long and kind of, you know, it's difficult to match them up with people unless someone has publicly made that information available, or you can look it up in your own transaction and you say, okay, I know that I sent, you know, on this day, I know I sent this to Bill and Bill's address is this. But I don't think a whole lot of people use it for anonymous purposes. There are ways you can make it anonymous, but it's very difficult right now and the technology hasn't really caught up to making it completely anonymous. Another way I would say people who are skeptical of Bitcoin, think of it as kind of like the internet in the early 90s or so. A lot of people had no idea that the internet would feature apps like Facebook or MySpace, or even email was something that was seen as, you know, this isn't going to be very widely used. You know, why would I need to use email when I can just send a fax or when I can just write a letter or something like that? Well, we saw email open up communication lines across the world. And in the same way that email has opened up those lines of communication, Bitcoin has opened them up in terms of currency and value. And this is really, really important if you need to send money to someone and maybe your government doesn't want to, or it's hard for you to afford through something like Western Union. Maybe you don't have the money to pay the fees that they're going to charge. So, yeah, simply said, Bitcoin is another currency, just like any other alternative currency that you can use, that is backed by basically a sector of computers that verify the transactions, and all of these transactions are recorded on a public ledger. So in some ways, it's really good for transparency. If you know that there's an organization that you're donating to and they use a particular address, you can look up and see, you know, how much money they've received, you know, maybe what they're doing with that money when they send it out. So it's very good for accountability.
And we'll have more about Bitcoin and a bunch of other stuff when we get back from this trip to the market.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Hey, this is Squizcar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now, so there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And Ask Me About My Worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Yeah, I guess we can...
Freedom Fiend.
Meow.
We're off in the break yapping and too busy talking to do a talk radio. So Megan, you you mentioned before when we were before we went to the break, you mentioned Western Union, and it reminded me, I was at Walmart not long ago with my wife, and I looked up and I saw the Western Union sign there, and the thought I've thought this before, but the thought just rammed home to me that if I were an investor in some business that's the old model, like Western Union or some of these other organizations that live on the business model of moving money from one place to another for a fee, if I had a business based on that, I would really be sweating right now. Or if I was a major investor in something like that, because if you decide, let's say you're in Gainesville, Florida, at the University of Florida campus, and you decide you want to use Western Union to send money, or no, the other way around, you want grandma to send you money so that you can have party money at the University of Florida. So you get a hold of her in Minnesota, and you're like, grandma, give me some money. And so she goes down to Western Union, and she's going to send you $100 for you to party this weekend. You're going to pay a crazy amount. It might cost you, I'm not sure exactly, but it might cost $10-$15 to get that $100. And if you're in...
That's about $10, yeah.
Yeah, for the 100. So, and if you're in some countries... Mm-hmm. And something happens, something bad happens, you lose your credit cards, you get robbed, whatever, you get a hold of your family back in the United States, and you're like, hey, I'm stuck in this strange, weird country, and I have no money, I have no identification, I don't even have money to get to the American embassy. Can you wire me some money? There are a number of countries in the world that you cannot wire Western Union. Western Union will not wire the money there. But if you can get on a laptop with internet access, you can move Bitcoin. And it's just that simple, and it's unbelievably cheap. For $100, I mean, what would it cost? Like a 14th of a cent or some crazy tiny amount like that? I can't even remember how much it cost with Bitcoin.
Yeah, it'll be about a half a percentage. It amounts to pennies, basically. And so Western Union doesn't have any real reason to change in the short term because they have a stronghold on the market. And this is why I think you're not seeing them changing their business plan at all, because I think they're very much stuck in the mindset that they're going to have that hold over the market for a long time. I think it's probably less long than they really think it is. I think they should be looking at things like Bitcoin as a threat, and they should be adjusting their business model accordingly if they want to survive. I think long term, it's just out for them if they don't start reevaluating, you know, how much money they're charging people and things like that. Right now, Western Union is, you know, probably the easiest way to send money. But like you said, there are problems, there are hangups, and, you know, Bitcoin can be a workaround for a lot of those things. And you can use Bitcoin you can convert it to a gift card, for example, really easily using an app like Gift, which is GYFT. I mean, you can buy airline tickets. You can buy all kinds of things. They list a ton of retailers, and it's really just takes a couple clicks on your phone or laptop to convert Bitcoin into a gift card that can be used just like cash, you know, at the places that it allows you to. And they're adding more and more to that every day. I mean, you can buy food from Whole Foods with it, airline tickets, clothing,
gasoline.
I mean, there, it's hard for me to think of anything you can't buy with Bitcoin, actually. And it's just money used for a whole number of things. So again, like other currencies, and this is something that I think is going to catch on eventually because of the funness of using it. Like it's really fast on, and it's new. And I think focusing on that could kind of bring people around to using it more often, and maybe, you know, starving Western Union and the banks a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of view businesses like Western Union and to a lesser extent the banks, but especially companies like Western Union, I kind of view them as wooden spoke manufacturers that are still in business in 1925 or something like that. You know, like how many wagons, you know, horse-drawn wagons are we going to need now that automobiles are to the state that they're at? And, you know, or horseshoe manufacturer. Sure, even today, people who, they're, you know, they're race horses, there are horses that for private ownership, they're, you know, recreational use. Some people just love their horses and like to ride them. And so there are still horseshoes that are manufactured and sold and installed, so to speak. But horseshoes are not the kind of industry they were in 1890. Because they've been replaced. It's just, it, you know, and that's what I think that Bitcoin is on the verge of doing. And I think a lot of banks, like there's a lot of banks that have shown interest in Bitcoin and are kind of playing around with it, trying to figure out how they can introduce it into their business model and so forth. And that's smart on the part of the banks. But now, as far as central banking goes, I'm not sure that the central bankers have fully recognized the potential of Bitcoin. I know there's probably some. I hate to, you know, generalize a whole group of people like that. I'm sure there's some people in central banking that are sitting back going, you know, we got a real problem with this Bitcoin thing. The question is, what do you do about it now? At this point in time, I'm not sure but what the blockchain technology has moved to the point of where it's not something that can be crushed anymore. There was a moment in time when if the central bankers had caught it in time, they could have crushed it. But I think we've gotten past that point now.
Well, it depends on what you mean when you say crush Bitcoin, too. So I think what you're going to see, what you've already seen in the case of the New York financial regulations, is they're targeting the centralized points of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin as a protocol is decentralized. It's spread out across a network of computers all around the world. But the exchanges at which you transfer Bitcoin into dollars, for example, and connect it to your bank account, like Coinbase is able to provide this service, that's where you fall into regulatory territory. And a lot of banks were refusing to do business with Bitcoin exchanges for a while because the regulations were kind of unclear. But I see this as something that the banks are probably going to go after the exchanges for, because they realize that it is a competitive industry. So, for example, when cars came out, you brought up the idea of, you know, the horse and buggy people still being around when cars were coming out. Some of the things they tried to use cars were outrageous. You can go back and look at some of the ads and the propaganda against cars, that they were these, like, you know, these death machines that just went too fast and they would just mangle people in the streets. And there were even places that proposed regulations like having someone come out, you know, several feet in front of a car to warn others that a car was coming because of this dangerous death machine that it was. And I think that's what you're seeing similar with the propaganda in Bitcoin is, you know, oh, it's dangerous, it's used for drugs, when really it's really not that dangerous. It's even a lot safer sometimes than some of their currencies, if you take the right precautions. So, but they're going to target the exchanges because those are the centralized points of failure. And until you can have more kind of decentralized exchanges, or you find some solution for that, like, for instance, not exchanging your Bitcoin back into dollars or another currency, and just using Bitcoin. I think that might be a good solution, but it's not always practical for everyone. So you're going to see this fight, I think, with the banks and the exchanges specifically, but you can't ban Bitcoin as a protocol, and you can't ban people or stop people from sending Bitcoin from one place to another. Unless, you'd have to target the entire internet to do that in your country, and even beyond that, and that's just impossible at this point.
One of the arguments that people make against Bitcoin also is that, you know, if something happens like there's a giant solar flare that hits the earth and wipes out all the computers or whatever, then you're going to be broke. All your wealth is gone. But what they don't realize is all of the ledgers that banks use to tell what is in your account, they don't have like little slips of paper. That's all on hard drives. And if there's some kind of a technological burp that wipes the internet out and wipes the computers out that hold the blockchain, you're not going to have any money in the bank either. As a matter of fact, the banks are just going to be, empty buildings. There will be no money as we know it if computers were to stop functioning tomorrow. It wouldn't just be Bitcoin. It would be all fiat currencies around the world, because they're all based on ledgers that are electronic. There's no longer, rows and rows and rows of guys with visors and their sleeves rolled up with, whatever those squishy things are that they held their sleeves up in the 1800s with a pencil behind their ear writing, account numbers on a piece of paper. That doesn't exist. That's not how banking is done. So that whole argument, I've heard that so many times. Well, if the internet goes down, you're broke. No, so are you, buddy. You ever tried to use an ATM?
Everyone's broke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a strange argument because it's so catastrophically based. Because there are practical problems with Bitcoin. Like, I'm not saying Bitcoin is this perfect technology that doesn't have problems. There are serious problems with Bitcoin, But that is not one of them. If something like that happens, like an EMP or something, crazy like that, you're going to have bigger problems to worry about than where your Bitcoins are. I mean, it's very catastrophic based, and it's completely unrealistic based. Again, you're going to have problems surviving. I mean, in that kind of scenario, it's not even sure whether or not gold or silver would have value. I mean, what are you basing, how do you look into different markets and stuff at this point without this structure? And it would be a long haul. Like I said, there would be a lot of other problems. The last thing you'd probably be worrying about is your Bitcoin. So
whenever somebody
it's a non-starter for me.
Yeah, whenever somebody uses that argument with me, I just in my mind I realize that they're doing a fallacy called appeal to fear. They're just they're saying. Mm-hmm. What if the zombies come and eat your face? What if North Korea attacks and we all die? What if the sun explodes and we all die tomorrow? It's just taking things to the most extreme fear level that you can get in order to get the person to stop thinking and just accept your premise. And that's not really logic. That's the opposite of logic.
Right. You can play the what if game all day, but it doesn't have any meaning unless those what ifs are valid. For example, what if Bitcoin doesn't scale? What if something else comes along that's a better way to transfer value and it just never catches on? That's a very possible what if. I mean, the market is constantly producing all of these interesting innovations in the form of finance and in the fields of finance and things like that. It's very likely that Bitcoin may not end up catching on with people and that it may not reach that potential that a lot of people would like to see it. So if we're going to play the what if game, we can be reasonable about it. They're legitimate what ifs, but EMP things knocking out the internet, that's not legitimate.
We'll be right back after this trip to the market.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
We'll be right back.
Freedom Fiends.
Meow.
We're wrapping up the end of the first hour on the Freedom Fiends. And I've been saying stuff like this lately. If you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio and you only get 1 hour, get a hold of you politely. Get a hold of your local radio station and let them know that you'd like to hear the other hour. Because, you know, if nobody tells them, they don't know. They picked the show up and maybe they picked it up for an hour. And who knows, you know, it might just be one polite caller to the radio station saying, hey, I like this show. Can you put it on another hour? That might be all it takes to get Freedom Fiends to be a full 2 hour show in your area.
Yeah, it gets weird in the second hour, so you definitely want to hear it.
Yeah. If you're only here in the first hour.
If you think the first hour's weird.
You wouldn't believe what we say in the second hour. And actually, let's tease a little bit for the second hour, because we want to talk about Free Ross and Ross Ulbricht. Ulbricht? Is that?
Yes.
Pronunciation? Yeah, that's right. It's
Ulbricht.
Ulbricht, that's it. And we'll maybe talk about the Silk Road a little bit. If you don't know what the Silk Road is, if you're listening on the radio, if you're on the internet listening to this as a podcast, the odds are like 99 to 1. You know what the Silk Road is, even if you never used it. But people out there listening on the radio might not know about the Silk Road, so we're going to talk about that a bit. That was an illegal marketplace on the internet that came under government attack, and we'll talk about that a bit. And we'll talk about Free Ross, because Ross is, to many people on the internet, including me, Ross is a hero, and he's been accused of some pretty horrendous things. And he's been convicted of some things, but he has not been convicted of the worst things that they accused him of. And I'm of the camp on that, and MK, you can give me your opinion on it, but I'm of the camp that, you know, specifically they accused Ross of murder plots. And from everything I have seen from government prosecutors and attorneys and judges and whatnot, if they can get you on a murder conviction, they'll do it. They'll do that before they get you on anything lesser than that. And they haven't got him on that. And I think if they really had the solid evidence for that, they would have pursued that first. Because normally they want to get you with the very worst thing they can get you on, and then everything else after that is just piles on in the convictions, you know, to get more and more years in federal prisons or whatever. But what's your opinion on that?
So this is such a complicated case. So Ross Ulbricht widely believed that he started the Silk Road, which was an online marketplace for any number of illegal things, mostly drugs. And actually, the main drug that was sold was marijuana. So there were a lot of other, you know, kind of worse drugs, I guess you could say, that were sold too. But it was mostly marijuana that was sold on the site. And this is something that was revolutionary as a starting factor. Like, it was very, no one had ever done this before. Black markets have always existed. Was ever able to create these, you know, recreational drugs on, had a decent rating system involved, and, you know, had very high customer satisfaction. So the invention of the Silk Road itself, I think, is a very revolutionary thing. And it's all, since it set such a strong precedent, you've seen a bunch of other online marketplaces pop up since then. So it is true that the government was able to stop Silk Road, but it hasn't been able to stop all of these other marketplaces too. And it's not really ever going to be able to. Now, it's really unfortunate that that drug marketplaces have to exist in such a way, because the general psyche hasn't shifted against the drug war. Even this whole narrative with Ross Ulbricht is very drug war heavy. The people who, for example, the DEA agents who were following after him and chasing after him. I mean, it reads like a really, I was reading this other article, it's the untold story of service agents, and they're trying to, you know, catch this evil, you know, drug maverick. And, you know, it's almost kind of cheesy, and it's almost, you know, glamorizing basically being an infiltrator. The Karl Mark Force, the DEA agent, and there was a secret service special agent named Sean Bridges. They infiltrated the Silk Road and impersonated Hell's Angels members, and you know, did a lot of bad things. We'll be getting into it a lot in the second hour, but they glamorized the lifestyle of being an infiltrator, you know, basically being an undercover agent. And I mean, as far as undercover agents go, they're probably the lowest of the low when it comes to cops. I mean, I'm not a big fan of cops. You know, I think it's freaky that they patrol the streets and they kill innocent people. But to intentionally insert yourself into a community where no harm has been done yet, there was no violence being perpetuated on the Silk Road. It was a completely peaceful enterprise that actually reduced violence in the drug trade by a whole lot. To do that, it's scummy behavior. And I'm going to go into that in the second hour and talk about why you shouldn't do that. But Silk Road as an idea has not been stopped. So I guess that's our redemption in the third act.
Yeah.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean. Available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Hour two of the Freedom Fiends. This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no-gov license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org, BIPCOT.org. And my name is Ben Stone. Welcome to the second hour of the Freedom Fiends. With me is MK. MK Lords, we were talking before in the first hour about Bitcoin, among other things, and then we were talking about the Silk Road a little bit, and we were talking about Ross, who is assumed to be or accused of being the original founder, the so-called Dread Pirate Roberts. And I want to throw in a couple things before we get back into that. First off, some background. The Dread Pirate Roberts is a reference to a movie that was a really cool movie called Princess Bride. And the premise of the Dread Pirate Roberts in The Princess Bride was that he was not one person. There was a guy once, and he was the Dread Pirate Roberts, and he had grown so successful that he had stepped out, and he had retired, and then he gave it over to another guy who became the Dread Pirate Roberts, and that guy was successful, and he retired, and then he gave it over to another guy. And so the idea of a Dread Pirate Roberts is that it is not one person. And I have believed very early on that Ross is only one of the Dread Pirate Robertses. And I believe there's quite a bit of evidence to that. Now, that doesn't give him a pass on everything he's accused of. And I don't know the details of what he really did and what he really didn't do. I know that the government, the government will play a lot of games in order to get you. And before the break, MK was talking about these, the worst of the worst of DEA agents are the ones who pretend to be something they're not and gain your trust and then turn on you, especially in a situation like with the Silk Road, where it was actually reducing the amount of violence and making these deals safer. You know, you can imagine for yourself, which is safer? For me to get in my car and drive to a seedy neighborhood in town and drive around and look for somebody who kind of looks like they might be holding drugs, and they're probably almost 100% guaranteed that they're armed and dangerous, and then I'm going to take cash up to them in a neighborhood like that and attempt to make a connection with some stranger. Now, of course, real drug deals usually don't happen like that. Usually it's people you know, talk to somebody else you know, and you get, you know, you develop a friendship. But there is still a substantial amount of drug deals that are done under very dangerous circumstances. And the Silk Road eliminated mm-hmm. that danger. It made it so that you could have a system of ratings so that you knew that other people had done business with this person and that they were not going to rip you off. And it allowed you to put the fundings into a secured location, and they stayed in that secured location until you received the things that you bought. And then once you received what you bought, then the fundings were sent on. So as opposed to pulling up next to somebody in a car, you hand them cash, and then they just say, "Eh, too bad for you, and what are you going to do?" Now it's down to a gun battle, right? So the Silk Road definitely made things safer. It definitely took the crime, the true crime element out of the process, and I think saved lives. How could it not have saved lives? And that's why I think the mm-hmm. government was so intent upon destroying it, because they saw that it killed the myths that, you know, drugs are evil, only bad people use them. Now I don't smoke marijuana, I don't use cocaine, I don't use anything like that. I haven't used any illicit substances of any kind since like 1980. So I'm not just some druggie looking for excuses to get my dopes. That's not the case at all. I'm a very realistic person that realizes that if no violence and if no force and no fraud is taking place and no violence is taking place, then whatever that two individuals agree to or whatever a person decides to put in their body is not my business. I have no business forcing other people to my beliefs. Anyway, there was my second hour rant, MK. Sorry about that. I have a tendency.
No, that's fine.
When a mic is in front of me, my mouth just goes.
That's what radio's for. So yeah, the Silk Road is such a fascinating experience. Like it was such an, you know, revolutionary attempt to reduce violence in the drug trade. Exactly like you said. And regardless of your feelings about drugs, you can look to the statistics and you can look to the studies done of how the Silk Road reduced violence. Wired.com actually has a really good article on this if you're looking for a good source. Yeah, it reduced violence in the drug trade by a significant amount. The fact that these these DEA officers were trying to infiltrate it and take down a totally peaceful operation shows the true motives of a government agency like the DEA. They're not interested in reducing violence around drugs. They're interested in ramping up the violence to further their own narrative that drugs are dangerous and bad. It's like, of course you're going to think drugs are dangerous and bad if the DEA is breaking down doors and killing people over them. The amount of violence that the government creates by prohibiting drugs far exceeds any argument, any kind of moral argument for why they should be illegal. I think I think it completely invalidates this argument that, oh, drugs are bad and they should be illegal. We've seen what prohibition has done, especially in the drug war. It's really been ramped up. And these are people's lives we're talking about. People's lives were being ruined over small amounts of drugs for decades now, and they still are in a lot of states. And the Silk Road changed this in a way that was much more peaceful. So I think I don't like to stop. I think it's a heroic thing, though. We're going to kind of go. Why don't we go into that a little bit over this? How it was infiltrated. You know, how it was really. It appears that it was really these DEA agents and Secret Service special agents who pushed things into violence, who perhaps maybe entrapped him to commit violence against someone who, and actually no one was killed in this, contrary to popular narratives, no one was killed in the Silk Road. What they did is they were able to compromise one of the administrators and fake his brutal, like they took pictures of where he looked, but he had been brutally beaten up by people that Ross Ulbricht allegedly hired. Now we're finding out that these same agents might have had admin access to the site, which means they could go in and change passwords and PIN numbers. And even it's possible, now this is still not completely verified, I went up and verified, but it was possible that they were able to gain admin access to alter chat logs, which is the main piece of evidence that's being thrown against Ross is, oh, they have all this evidence of him making these giant chat logs, talking with people he thinks are hitmen, basically, and putting hits on people and transferring Bitcoin to these accounts to, you know, make hits on people. that's what they were trying to focus on. That's going to be the focus on his upcoming trial in Maryland. In New York, it was more focused on is he morally culpable for any drug dealings that were going on as an administrator of the site who wasn't involved in selling or, you know, buying drugs himself. Which set a bad precedent.
Yeah, that's what I started to say. It's a strange argument that they made and made successfully.
Yeah, right. I mean, this would be similar to saying, oh, well, we shouldn't have places like eBay because people can sell bad stuff on eBay or Craigslist. You know, we should fine the person who create or imprison the person who created Craigslist because sometimes murderers go on Craigslist and use it for bad things. I mean, that's actually happened, unfortunately, on Craigslist. Or as a result of Craigslist. But that's a risk you take whenever you operate a business like that. And even with Silk Road, I think it is reasonable to assume that if this was actually Ross acting as an admin and, you know, putting hits on people, that when you're operating that type of business, it gets really dark really quickly. And you can talk about principles all day, but when it comes down to business and you have someone threatening to rat you out to the government over something as massive as the Silk Road, then your mind is probably going to go towards violent solutions to this. The drug trade is not without violence now. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I think it's, you know, I've talked with Lynn Ulbricht, I think his mother, who is a wonderful and completely believes in his innocence. And it's hard for me because there's so much coming out in this case on one side or the other that, you know, I think it's reasonable to think someone's principles and mindset can change over time when they reach a certain point of notoriety, especially on a site like this. It's dealing with, you know, still illegal product.
Yeah,
but there's also a lot of evidence that there was infiltration and manipulation and possibly outright fabrication of what actually happened in the chat logs.
I want to touch on that too, what you said about Craigslist, because I think that's really critical to understand. If you are of the camp that says Ross is guilty and should be punished because he set up a place where people could go and do something illegal, well, then you have the Craigslist argument. Okay, then how is it that Craigslist, a place where people can, it has been set up so that people can go there and do something illegal, well, how do you not go after Craigslist? But it's also the same to say, well, but what about every bar? Isn't a bar a place where people mm-hmm. could go and discuss, say, murder or make a drug deal or where a prostitute could hang out and a John could come in and connect up? Or isn't a bar a place? Well, sure, but then isn't McDonald's? Isn't McDonald's a place where two people could go in, sit down, and plot a murder? Isn't that a plausible thing? I'll bet there has been a murder plotted in a McDonald's, but that doesn't mean McDonald's did anything wrong. To say that the Silk Road, the operators of the Silk Road are guilty because of what other people did, is just backwards to everything in Western civilization that we've understood about responsibility of the individual.
Mm-hmm. And it's really important to note that there was no violence in the Silk Road until government agents infiltrated it and fabricated and actually physically captured one of the other administrators and started making threats and started pushing Ross or Dread Pirate Roberts, if he was someone else, into actions that he felt were desperate, that were totally out of desperation. So that's the biggest thing, I think, to take away from this whole case with Ross Ulbricht, is he was operating a peaceful online marketplace that sold things that, you know, maybe some people have moral prohibitions against, whatever. But it reduced violence, and that violence didn't ramp up until government agents came in and forced it to be like that.
Yeah. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
For some reason in this country, and in most of the Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FiendPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Freedom Fiends, coming at you. Through the radio tubes. And we are back here with Ben Stone, and we were talking about the Silk Road case and Ross Ulbricht. He's gone through one already and will be facing another one in Maryland as the operator, the accused operator of the Silk Road online marketplace. The drug war is all related. This is one of those very bad policies that comes from a lot of people thinking that the government should force their morality on other people, especially if they are peaceful. And this is why I think a lot of the freedom fiends are philosophically aligned with anarchism. And we often have other libertarian comrades that are a little bit, maybe they're not fully sold on this. But for me, the drug war really, really pushed me in the direction of philosophical anarchism. So why don't we cover this article that I came across? It's called Five Reasons I'm Not an Anarchist. And because when people hear things like the Silk Road, they think, oh, this is this terrible thing, the internet from, I guess, allowing people to purchase drugs peacefully. I want to cover this article. It's a Libertarian Republic article, and there's a lot of overlap with libertarians and anarcho-capitalists specifically. And we're going to kind of cover, I guess, some of the myths. This author says he's not an anarchist, he's a constitutional libertarian. And we're going to kind of cover maybe why we disagree with it, or maybe why we think some of his points are valid. So the number one reason is rights are guarantees. And he says a right is something that must be provided. Any society aimed at protecting natural rights must use some type of force to guarantee those rights. Any mechanism of force used to guarantee those rights have the same effect as government, no matter what the form may take. What are your thoughts on this, Ben?
I think he is confused. I do not view rights like that at all. First off, and I think he has a logical fallacy there, he assumes that the job of society is to provide protection of natural rights. And in fact, a society may or may not protect natural rights. I mean, you think about our society, and I think I have the right of self-protection. And included in that right of self-protection, I have the right to arm myself in the way that I choose. And yet this society does nothing to protect that. And somebody might say, oh, you've got the Second Amendment. And you know what? The government tramples on the Second Amendment constantly because the government's the one that wrote the Second Amendment. They're the ones that enforce the Second Amendment upon themselves. And look at what a great job they're doing. In some places, I can't carry specific guns because, some politician who's never touched a gun has decided that that type of a gun is dangerous and bad and nasty and evil. And so society doesn't necessarily provide rights through force. That's not how it's done. I would make the argument that let's take a squirrel. I talk a lot about birds and squirrels and junk like that, things, animals that would be in your yard. And let's just consider a squirrel for an example. Now, squirrels they have what might be called a society, a group of squirrels interacting with each other, and there's mating that takes place, and there's they share warmth, and there's things like this that happen in a community of squirrels. And they have within their community certain rights, one to the other. So one squirrel will behave in a certain way all the time within that society of squirrels. And the reason he does that is because it's his nature to do so. It's more profitable for him as an individual squirrel, and built within the nature of all squirrels, it's profitable to their species. So rights, in my mind, come from you as a species. It comes from your origins in your species. So there are certain rights that I have as a human that a squirrel doesn't have, and there are certain rights that are within a squirrel society that don't affect me, that I don't have. So to say that rights are guarantees and it's that something that must be provided by society, you're assuming a socialist position to begin with. You're assuming that without the and he confuses the word society and government, and these people always do this. I hate to sound like that, but they always do that. They always confuse society and government. Well, what you're really saying in this number one reason here is that if you don't have a government giving you those rights, then you don't have rights. I mean, that's really the essence of what he says. So if you really break that down, what he's really saying is rights come from government. And that's just flat wrong. They do not. I have certain rights, whether or not there's a government, whether or not there's a society to provide me those rights. I have them. They pre-exist society. Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I totally agree. Nobody owes you anything. Even rights, unfortunately. So we're going to delve a little bit deeper into this wormhole in just a bit here. We'll move on to number two here after this trip to the market.
I get out of control sometimes.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends.
I thought about touching on the... I think we should just move on.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been using Block It Pocket, and I love it. Block It Pocket protects your cell phone, tablet, or laptop from remote tracking and data theft. I've tested it. It works. Put your cell phone inside, call from another phone, and the phone in the Block It Pocket won't ring because all signals in and out are blocked. Avoid calls and texts at the wrong moment. Keep your location private. Protect passports and credit cards. Water-resistant, hand-washable, and stylish in many designs. Go to blockitpocket.com. That's blockitpocket.com.
Ow! Worms.
So, what were you saying?
All right. We were talking about this article we came across on the Libertarian Republic called Five Reasons I'm Not an Anarchist. And I want to say that this guy's really saying five reasons I'm not an anarcho-capitalist. And I'll explain why. I said we were going to move on to the second reason, but I want to stick to just this one sentence in the first reason he gives. And he says, a fully privatized law system would be justice for sale to the highest bidder. This assumes an anarcho-capitalist position of privatized law. If you want to talk about anarchism as a political or philosophical idea, to go back quite a while, and you have to look at a lot of different forms of legal systems that could arise from different forms of anarchism. So right off the bat, the title's completely inaccurate because anarchism is a very broad philosophical school, and fully privatized law systems is specifically anarcho-capitalist. So it assumes that we would live in an anarcho-capitalist society, which I'm a panarchist who believes that there would be competing systems, things like that. That's kind of what I think would naturally arise. So, but I'm just going to go ahead and move on because we want to keep this moving. The second reason, and this I think is probably for me the strongest argument against any form of anarchism. And he says, number two, an anarchist society is unable to protect its citizens from foreign invasion. And I would note that while this is true in current day, to a degree in current day society, the problem arose from the fact that states have historically waged war on each other and on people. You have to have a state with this huge monopoly on violence in order to wage war in the first place. It's been states who've been attacking anarchist societies, you know, since the beginning of time, any time an attempt has been made. What do you think about this argument, Ben?
Yeah, he's basically making that old, tired, worn-out argument that if we didn't have a state, then somebody would make a state. Or if we didn't have government, a government would come and get us. It's, first off, it's fear-based. It's not logic-based. And it's admitting that, you know, governments are a bad thing and if you don't like them. You know, everybody on this, on the whole political spectrum thinks that government is a bad thing, except for when it's the flavor they like. Then it's suddenly a good thing magically. So it's, you know, it's fear-based. It's, plus, it's blatantly false in the sense that, you know, there have been... let me say this first. It's also assuming a boogeyman. This guy seems to be obsessed with North Korea in this whole article. I don't know who, if it's male or female, who wrote it, because I couldn't find an author's
Austin
name.
Austin Peterson.
Oh, is it? Oh, well, that explains some things, but I won't go down that road. But it assumes, like I think he's got some kind of fear of North Korea, because he brings it up several times. And you have to realize, if, as soon as somebody starts telling me, you know, you have to be afraid because North Korea, I think, you know, you're talking about one of the poorest, weakest countries in the world that the American media loves to make a boogeyman out of. And you're going to scare me with that?
Yeah.
You know, it's just not a realistic thing. And then he also makes the statement that, you know, he uses the native U.S. Americans, or the Native Americans, I should have said. He uses Native Americans as an example of where you have an anarchist community that's invaded by a government-based community, and the anarchist community loses, and loses bad. And yes, that is what happened. But another way to look at it is you have a mid-Stone Age society that's invaded by another society that's right on the verge of the Industrial Age. And so you have people with rock weapons and you have people going against them with gunpowder. And then now we're going to say it's because of the government? I mean, this is a real twisting of history, and it's cherry picking your argument. It's really not a logic based thing. It's really mostly just fear that he's throwing at you. Let me say this too.
This is a bizarre sentence.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is a bizarre sentence. The very last sentence of this section is, they should be free to join together for mutual protection, provided they do not infringe on the fundamental natural rights of other citizens doing so. Talking about militias, basically. Where in anarchism does it say people can't do that? Of course people would join together for mutual protection.
Yeah, and the funny part is the government
hates
that.
I don't see how that's, like, that's like a gotcha, like.
Yeah. And the government hates that. Every time the government sees private people forming private militias, they want to demonize you. They want to arrest you. They want to infiltrate you with government agents that want to come in and stick their nose in and try to get you to do something wrong so they can arrest you. So, I mean, it's not real. His argument is not a realistic one.
And let's move on to the next one. Number three, anarchy means the non-aggression principle is optional. Now, hold on. Depends on what type of anarchy you're talking about here. Now, ANCAPs do have almost religious devotion to the non-aggression principle. And I think it's a good principle to start with if you want a peaceful society. I think it is incomplete on its own. But again, this is an anarcho-capitalist viewpoint. This is not necessarily applicable to other forms of anarchy. And he says, if you believe in the non-aggression principle, whose job is it to enforce it? If someone breaks into your home and you're unable to defend yourself or pay for private security, who do you call? So what's your take on this little part here?
At several times in this article, including in this segment, he displays an ignorance of something called the free rider principle or the free rider concept. And in the free rider concept, you have it's based on the idea that if you don't charge individual fares for people riding a bus, then anybody can just jump on the bus and ride for free, then the ones paying for the bus are actually giving a free ride to the freeloaders that are not paying. So that's where the thought comes from. And in economics, the Austrian style of economics that ANCAPs tend to lean towards, the free rider problem actually solves these issues like this. So that what we actually see in reality in places like Detroit, where there is a very well-growing private police force that are stepping in and taking the place of the public police force that is failing dramatically, we have private police providing police protection for individuals that are not even paying for the service. They're getting that as a free rider mm-hmm. because they happen to be in that neighborhood where one or two businesses are paying for private security. And because one or two businesses are paying for the private security, there's literally hundreds of people in the neighborhood that are getting free police and good police, private police, not the kind that beat them up, but the kind that actually serve them. So, you know, just the other thing.
Yeah.
He makes this argument. He's actually making the exact same argument that Elizabeth Warren, a hardcore socialist, makes in a very well-known YouTube video where she talks about, you know, if it wasn't for the government, then the hordes of biker gangs would just come and tear and rob you and tear down your factory. And she makes this ridiculous claim in there. And I think that what a lot of people, especially these so-called conservatives, so-called, you know, constitutionalists, I think they don't realize that they are making a socialist argument. That's exactly what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned the police force in Detroit. It's called Threat Management Center, and they specialize in de-escalating confrontational situations. They don't even carry weapons, actually. So this is it's an innovation in protecting people, and they do protect people who aren't paying them either. They are seemingly altruistic with that. They carry non-lethal weapons if they have to protect themselves, and they use de-escalation tactics to split up disputes. And so far, they haven't killed anyone. They've been in operation for, I'd say, a couple of years now. So this idea that, oh, the protection only belongs to the rich is, I don't think it's very realistic. So, and this brings us to, let's see, number four, the non-aggression principle. I didn't sign, and it says expletive, which is a reference to what anarchists say when they say the Constitution is a social construct or a social contract that I didn't sign. So he tries to flip it over and say the non-aggression principle is a social contract, but I didn't sign it, and neither did the enemies of liberty. And he's saying that anarchists sneer at constitutionalists, arguing that they didn't sign the document or agree to it. I don't know any anarchists who are saying that the non-aggression principle would be strictly enforced. And again, this is an anarcho-capitalist argument. Not every anarchist society would choose to abide by the non-aggression principle. And I don't see how this is an argument against the non-aggression principle in favor of the Constitution at all. Because there's, again, the same arguments, the same critiques he's using apply to the Constitution, whether you want to say, you can argue that, oh, there are a lot of different interpretations of the non-aggression principle, and it seems that anarchists can't even agree on that. That's true, but you have the exact same problem with the Constitution. You have this contract that no one signed that is interpreted wildly by different people. And so, I mean, you have like intentionality involved, like what were the founders' intentions? And then you have people arguing, well, what it says basically, like I'm a conservative and it only says this. And then you have liberals who are like, oh, it's a living document. Like, I don't see how a piece of paper that says this is how we will organize society could even really be agreed upon by a large variety of people. Everyone's going to have their own different interpretation.
Yeah, and to say that the non-aggression principle is a social contract is just wrong. It's not. It's a philosophy, and there's nothing enforcing it upon anyone. And the other thing that he does there is, I think he kind of assumes that everybody who believes in the non-aggression principle is also a pacifist, because he actually uses that word pacifist in some way. I can't remember the exact. I can't see the exact spot he uses it. But he makes this same confusion that so many people make, that if you believe in the non-aggression principle, that you have to be a pacifist, that you can't have self-protection, that you have to wait. Like he uses the thing as somebody's pointing a gun at you. Well, you know what? I believe in the non-aggression principle, but if somebody points a gun at me and makes a viable threat, then I'm going to take action against them. I'm not going to wait until they shoot me to take that action. And I don't know of any anarchists that would stand there and let themselves be shot, you know, other than true pacifists.
Right. And something I will say, a critique I do have of the non-aggression principle is that it is reductive, and I think it does need supplementary philosophy to, if we're talking about applying it to a larger social order. It's imperfect in itself, and I would say you know, it requires a degree of civility and politeness to have peaceful society, and that just simply abiding by the non-aggression principle is problematic because you can do any number of rude, brutish, antisocial behaviors and still be within the non-aggression principle.
Right.
So I like to call it the DBAP, the don't be an a-hole principle. Add that to the NAP, and I think you have a better balance.
We're going to be right back after this trip to the market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Freedom Fiends, wrapping up the final hour. My name is Ben Stone with MK Lords. And what was the number fifth objection, MK?
Yeah, we are on number five of five reasons this particular individual is not an anarchist. And he gets to number five, which is private property. And I'm going to take the devil's advocate position and agree with him on this reason. It's not a reason why I'm not an anarchist, though. I do agree with the premise of it, which is, who defines what is private property? In an anarchist society, there's no commonly accepted definition. So what he does in this section, we were talking about this, is the first four critiques were critiques of anarcho-capitalism, which is a very specific school of anarchism. But in number five, he just decides to combine all of the different types of schools and say, this is why I'm not an anarchist, because they can't agree on property. Well, of course they can't agree on property. Anarchism is a very large philosophical school with lots of different beliefs about property.
You know,
so what are your thoughts on this, Ben?
What I was thinking about that is, you know, if you're talking to someone who is not a Christian, let's say, and you say, well, you know, what objections do you have to Christianity? And if their objection is that Christians can't agree, if that's the whole objection you have, well, then yeah, no, Christians can't agree. They can barely agree on the name of the main person within their religion. I mean, you know, of course they don't agree, but that's that in and of itself, it's like, you know, that's not really an argument. Yeah, there are all kinds of different anarchist schools of thought, and they do not agree on property, and property is a major aspect of what we're talking about here. But that doesn't mean you throw out the entire thing and say, that's why we have to have a government forcibly taking taxes from us, robbing us, forcing us into servitude in the military, forcing us to have to endure, you know, centuries of warfare and murderous leaders that kill millions of people. That's why, because five or six people can't agree on property, therefore we have to kill a few million people. That's ludicrous. That's, I mean, I hate to be rude, but that's just stupid and lazy. I mean, and I agree with you.
And I agree with that.
Go ahead.
It doesn't make, just because some anarchists can't agree on what property is, doesn't mean the default position should be that we need a government to enforce this strange idea of what property is that is very highly specific to a certain society. And so I can agree that I don't have I don't necessarily believe in the anarcho-capitalist view of property sometimes. I've been told by a lot of them that, oh, property is something that's justly acquired and, you know, is peacefully acquired. Well, that would invalidate most of the land in the United States because it was forcefully acquired from the indigenous inhabitants. Again, though, that's not a reason for the government to give reparations to people, or it's not a reason for the government to come in and declare that there needs to be this standard of private property. I think there should be competing ways to figure out what is actual property, what is, you know, what are the ways we can work through this problem, if it can be worked through. This has been debatable since the first time someone claimed something else as their own. You know, what is property? This is a deep discussion that I don't think can be summed up between, well, whether you should be an anarchist or a minarchist. And this is a strange sentence I want to point out. He says, without a firm definition of what constitutes private property, there can be no reliable transactions between parties. That's rather silly. I can send Bitcoin to an anarcho-communist that has a completely different view of what private property is. I mean, currency, when I think of transactions, at least, I think of currency, and I don't think that a difference in philosophical agreement necessarily stops transactions or trade from happening.
Yeah,
that's a rather bold claim.
He's basically making an argument like this. I like pudding, you like Jell-O, therefore Africa.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre thing, and I wish he would have been more specific. I think he needs to do a little more reading on the different schools of anarchism. I think he probably would align more closely with anarcho-capitalism, but anarchism too is something I kind of take, I guess, a Carl Hess view of anarchism, and I think he has a pretty well balanced view. He says basically an anarchist, the only kind. I'm sorry, an anarchist is a person opposed to authority imposed through the hierarchical power of the state. You know, anything else after that, you build philosophy on top of that. But you can be an anarchist with just one simple principle. Just opposition to imposed authority.
Yeah.
So, well. And then you just add schools of thought on top. So.
And it's mostly just about treating each other the way you want to be treated. What's so hard about that? What's so terrible about that?
Right.
Thanks for me and you being on the show together, Megan. I said that backwards.
It was great. Always a blast. It's all-